From Ellen's basement on East 10th Street in...
begrudgingly.
Duluth, Minnesota, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game Devs talk games and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I live here.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Crowley, and I made the trip. For this week's episode, our topics are instructions and cynicism. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start.
Gotcha.
Ellen's place.
Ellen's place.
Steven and I drove up.
Yes.
We brought the microphones.
Yes.
And that's the whole story.
That's it. Really, for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've been back up in Duluth.
Yeah. You didn't really have a great time here when you were living here last.
Right. I was flunking school for the second time. It wasn't great. I'm not going to go into the details, but I didn't like it here. Uh-huh.
So I'm trying to reset his impression. No,
it's not really working.
No, it's not going to work, but I'm trying to at least, you know, be one thing. That's a good reason for Steven to visit Duluth. So we hung out a bit. Mm-hmm. I did the tour.
Yes.
We went to the Board Game Cafe.
Uh-huh. That was nice.
Then you played a game I didn't know I had in my Switch.
Yeah.
And then we went to get. Yeah, we got burgers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been nice so far.
Yeah, on the way up here, I knew that Steven was a little bit sensitive about his time in the city.
Right.
And so when we got in, it was about lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Ellen had some work stuff to wrap up before we stopped in. We were a little early.
Mm-hmm.
So I took Steven on a date
to
the Revolving Restaurant overlooking Lake Superior.
Yeah.
It was kind of great.
It was kind of nice, actually. Yeah, I don't think I've ever been on a rotating revolving restaurant before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of neat, weirdness of it, I guess.
Yeah. Every like 2 minutes we looked up and like, whoa.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
It was all the dumb reactions everybody has the first time they do it. I've been to a revolving restaurant and I had all the same dumb reactions.
I have that impression of people, I think.
I've lived here for many years.
Yeah.
Not this time, but prior to that. I've been here for several months now. But I've never been to the Revolving Restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now I'm like thinking, I'm like, oh yeah, of course they did that. Because if they just had a circular restaurant, everyone who was sitting away from the lake would get really mad. Right?
Yeah.
50% great view, 50% trash.
Yeah, half of it is kind of highway.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When we went to the Board Game Cafe earlier today, that was a nice time too.
Yeah.
We just completed it. All we did was like, we chatted for a bit and then we talked about, completed a puzzle with cats on it.
A 500-piece puzzle.
Yes.
Because Dale is not here on the trip with us.
Yeah.
So we needed to do something that Dale would have made us do.
Right.
Yes. If she were here.
Yes. She would have absolutely made us do that. Yes.
Yes. It was fun. I don't do puzzles very often.
Yeah, same. Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever do them alone.
It was actually really fascinating because, Mark, you've been watching the, professional puzzle
players
or something.
I watch a YouTube channel called Karen Puzzles.
Yeah.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
She's a charming, charming woman
mm-hmm.
who has a speed puzzler YouTube channel. She's a great ambassador for the, I don't want to call it a sport, but for the whatever it is. But she goes to tournaments and stuff. And then what I really like is when she does, talks about like old puzzles from the 70s and like the brands and the, it's all very fascinating and dorky. I had never, anytime watching hours and hours of this YouTube channel, ever was that interested in ever doing a puzzle myself.
Yeah.
And then I found out that Dale also watched YouTube puzzle videos.
Oh,
and we didn't. Neither of us knew what the other one did.
Oh,
wow. Now we watch them together.
Oh, that's
so cute.
It's pretty adorable.
Very cute. So cute.
That's wonderful.
Mm. Yeah. So you guys were saying you don't really do puzzles that much. And I was thinking like, well, I kind of know about puzzles.
Yeah.
And you were both way better than me at it.
You know, we ended up getting into it pretty good.
I was like, just staring at one part of the puzzle for half the time.
Yeah, there was that period of time where I was like looking at the pile and you were working on something with a particular color palette.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about this because as I was looking for different pieces and working on different cats within the puzzle.
Yeah.
Then I was like catching my brain shifting from, okay, you're no longer looking for turquoise. Now you're looking for red.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, there's this period of time where we were looking for purple and white,
mm-hmm.
and Mark's like, figuring out. And I just kind of, like, found the next puzzle, handed it to Mark, and knew exactly where to put it. And he found the next piece, I handed it to Mark, and knew exactly where to put it.
Yeah.
We were, like, a serviceable team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, some of those speed puzzlers really speed puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we we did drop a couple of pieces on the floor, which cost us, like, minutes.
Yeah.
We missed the record by some amount.
an appreciable amount.
Yep, yeah. Yep. So if you haven't noticed already, this one's going to be a little bit of a loopy one.
Yes.
Tune in next week because, well, also stay tuned in this week.
Don't I mean, anywhere. Yes.
That's the show.
We welcomed you to our program. Please be polite. Uh-huh. The rest. I'm really excited about our topics, yeah. But I want to say next week, we're going to talk about Roboston again. You've heard us talk about the show a couple of times, and we've teased this in the past couple of weeks that we were coming up to see Ellen to hang out over the weekend because we were going to do some work on the game.
Yeah.
And we're recording an episode now, and we're going to release that, and then we're going to record an episode tomorrow, which we'll release a week from now for you, which is going to be after we do that work.
Yes.
And so it'll be a little bit of a postmortem of like what we did and why.
Yeah.
So we're kind of, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
Which means we shouldn't waste any time because the sooner we get this done, the sooner we'll get to that. Is that how this,
true.
Is that how time works?
That's how time works.
Yeah. but first, Stephen, something about SpongeBob. Ellen, you were saying we should change the way we do milestones to like what shows we beat.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got more episodes than SpongeBob does. Haha. Get wrecked. That's all I had to say about that.
How many episodes is that?
It was like 319 from what I could tell.
Oh, so we're a good way back.
Blue pass.
Yeah.
We should just wait until we feel like doing a milestone and then find a show that we surpass.
Okay. Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, in that spirit, longtime listeners will know that when we hit 179, I made a hubbub about how that was more episodes than Star Trek The Next Generation, mm-hmm. and that was a fun moment for me. and then we were like, what do we have? We're like looking up what 362 is more than.
Yeah.
And we couldn't find an exact one, but I will say, if you take all the episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation,
uh-huh.
and add all the episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine,
uh-huh.
and add all the original series movies,
okay.
we just beat that.
Hey.
Wow.
So it's a fairly arbitrary number.
Yeah. Not as monumentous as beating SpongeBob, but you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I know I just suggested the opposite of this, but now I want to know who our next target is.
Yeah.
We'll figure that out.
Okay. Listeners, if you know, there's got to be animes up and down this scale.
Oh, yeah.
Like they drop off every 25 episodes after 300, right?
Right. When do we beat One Piece? That's the real task.
We'll never beat One Piece.
True.
Actually. It's like if one train leaves at 25 miles an hour and another train leaves at 25 miles an hour, but 3 hours later, is they're just going to never catch the second one.
Yep, you're right. You're right.
Okay, so we couldn't decide whose topic should do what, who hosts with something. A little bit lost, but the way we do the show is you heard me at the top of the show. That means I'm the host of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other two of our lovely, nice hosts will bring a topic. We couldn't figure out exactly which of Ellen or I should do a topic.
Yeah, actually, we
because
were
Because Steven brought a topic, even though it was his turn.
Exactly.
This is all inside baseball. But what this means is that the long and short of it is that Ellen and I are doing a topic together.
Yes.
Yep.
Which, I don't know, doesn't mean anything. But
also true.
Again, it's a loopy one.
It means we'll get less credit.
I honestly have had to, like, how do I notate it in the spreadsheet?
Oh, yeah, true. Oh, goodness.
When three game devs start a podcast, they're going to put rules and systems on things.
Uh-huh.
And that requires what, Ellen?
Colors.
Well. Instructions.
I that up for you.
Such a setup.
Ellen, our topic is
instructions.
We'll splice that in so it sounds like you're real smart.
You can just leave it.
Okay.
We warned them this was going to be a weird one.
We did.
Yeah,
we did.
So we're talking about instructions for a couple of reasons. One is that's one of our tasks for tomorrow.
Yes,
is we're going to rewrite the instructions for Roboston, move it away from a technical document more towards a teaching document. And so we'll talk a little bit about that now because it's going to be a good comparison to next week's episode where we let you know how we did.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, tune in for that. But I also want to talk a little bit about the instructions we did for Glom, which is our card game, party game, word game that we had published last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that, Ellen, you led the charge on putting those instructions together.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of served as a copy editor. And then our publisher, Sydney, who worked at the publisher, did a final pass on it and really gave us good notes to sort of get the final version going.
Yeah.
And so that process was really exciting. But it's been a little while since we've done it. And so we should maybe talk about that and like what that process was like for us. Because we had never... Well, Ellen, you probably had more of a technical writing background than either the two of us had.
Mm, yeah.
But this particular task, none of us had ever done.
Right.
So, Ellen, you started it. So, how did you begin the approach for it?
Yeah. So, at that point in time, did a lot of writing of training, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, when you think of technical writing, you're thinking of like a technical manual that helps you put stuff together.
Yeah.
This, you know, this is the kind of writing that teaches you how to do the process, right? Yeah. So similar kind of thing. It's just meant to be more of a training setting than a like consumer setting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a lot of related practice. And so when you're doing something like that, you want to be really specific about the actions and the outcomes and the context. So you're almost like you're designing a level and a path through that. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about how each step or part of a step leads into the next thing and what context people are coming from to move into that, because everything connects, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So the way that I thought about doing the instructions was kind of like that. Like, okay, here's your setup. That's one chunk.
Yeah.
And lots of games do that. It's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'm really doing anything new. It's just what I thought about, right?
Yeah.
And then really for standard play, I just action by action at a very granular level. And then when we published them, there was color coding. I will point that out. Very helpful color coding.
Yeah.
So colors. Anyway. yeah. And I think that kind of just the way that they laid it out also kind of makes it clear what the sections are. I don't know.
Right.
I think that like the graphic design of the menu is really, really good. So it's, for me, it's not that, I think for me as a player, what can get frustrating is when a manual of instructions says more about like the systems of the game rather than the actions, or at least I would like to see both of those sections.
Yeah, yeah. I like that differentiation, the systems versus the actions, because one might conflate one or the other. I know I would.
Yeah.
But I think that like what you're actively doing in the game is important versus like thinking about the whole of the game is something that you don't necessarily need at jump, right? You kind of just need to know how to get started, and then you can kind of establish a strategy as you go.
We had maybe an easier time of it on Glom.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that board game instructions always do is like, what's the goal of the game?
Yeah.
To get 7 victory points or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, how that's expressed is different for different types of games, and different instructions can do it differently. And then that is essentially supposed to be what you hold on to as you start reading about like what the actions are. But so many board games, the distance between those things is so far that that's I think a big part of the challenge is to like, how do you keep people on the train of that? While explaining to them that like the exchange rate between these tokens and those tokens without ever, because on this turn you can buy this, but then you don't actually know why you would ever do that.
Yeah.
And so like, I would say a lot of board game instructions just let you read through it, start playing, and then kind of piece it all together.
Yeah.
Because to really lay it all out linearly in the instructions would make most instructions 4 times longer.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a desire in writing an instruction manual to talk through each system in completion rather than thinking about it the way that a person who's learning the game approaches it, right?
Right.
And in that said, instead of like starting with one system and going to the next system and going to the next system, you approach the system like a pyramid, and you can only like increase the amount of pyramid that you're expressing. I'm like poking into my own brain, so this is a terrible analogy. But like, you can only introduce another layer at a time.
Yes. Right. And the right order of that is tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you want to make sure that anything you're not telling the player is something that they don't need to know to understand what you are telling them now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like, you know, you'll get, this will make more sense later when you're teaching a game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's unavoidable because things sometimes have circular dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
But like how you describe it, you have to describe it in a way that doesn't rely on those dependencies.
Yeah.
Or you have to acknowledge them, but not in a way that interrupts with another whole system.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You have to let people understand it, even though they will get the full context later.
Yeah.
Don't ask that. Ask that of them now.
Or, you summarize it. So, like, you know, you're explaining how you get different resources in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but you haven't yet got to the point where you can, like, trade those resources. You can just say, these resources are available for trading, which we'll cover in a couple pages.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I find that to be really helpful when they're like, this is such and such. Then they'll give you a base, like, description of what this is. But, like, if you want more information, go to page 13 or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that's nice.
And there's a that hints at the dual role of an instruction manual.
Yes.
Which is, it's to teach the game, but also to then look up the rules later.
Right.
Yes, it becomes reference material.
Right.
And you don't generally, most games don't treat those as different documents, but those are different documents.
Those are different documents,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You really nailed it, Mark. I think that is the issue.
I nailed it.
You nailed it.
I think that a lot of games lean a little bit more towards the reference manual and not enough on the instructions manual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it was Ascendancy. I know we have this as an example of maybe a game. Well, no, it's still a game that had, I think, frustrating instructions. Are we ready for that part?
Sure, let's dive in.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm probably wrong in my memory of this, but I seem to remember there being like a really big reference and then something like a quick guide page or something.
For
like
Star Trek Ascendancy.
For Star Trek Ascendancy, yeah. Do I remember that correctly?
I think there is a... Yeah, that's actually a good question.
I don't think it has.
What it is the first two pages try to like lay out how the game works in as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
But you don't really come off those two pages with much. Is my memory of it.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately it is mostly a reference manual.
Yes.
And then the thing you read, you just have to hold on to until it makes sense three pages later.
Yes.
And then it does make sense. But like, and actually, honestly, once you, I know we've talked about how much we like this game. Mm. And I still think it's brilliant, and I think that its instructions do not do it credit, because it is not that complicated of a game once you understand it. It is an elegant system, but actually explaining it is a... I don't know how hard it would be to write good instructions for that game,
yeah.
But the ones that exist are not great.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what I ended up having a hard time with that game, is like, it was difficult to understand what I was doing when I first started out.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, I guess I didn't feel like a lot of guidance from the instruction.
Well, they do exactly what Ellen was saying you shouldn't, which is that describe each system in isolation.
Right.
Rather than like your actions in sort of relation to the...
Yeah, and by the time you get to actually playing the game, you'll forget half of that because it wasn't actually relevant to playing the game.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which makes it an okay reference material.
Right.
Right, but I had issues with that as a reference material because...
That's a separate problem there.
Yeah, that's a separate problem, but like a lot of the things that they would describe, they were not clear about enough for me to feel good. And so a lot of my memory of recent games we've been playing Ascendancy is us arguing about whether or not this thing should work or not, because it just wasn't specific enough.
I don't know about recent, but that did happen a lot for a while, where it's like, what is the actual rule of this? What does it actually mean? The disambiguation.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a problem with big games, but I think that was definitely a fault of the technical writing in that manual, for sure, that a lot of that could have been avoided.
Yeah. But you're right, though. They are separate.
Yeah.
This was a separate issue.
I'm trying to give it as much credit as possible because we don't have a comparison for what the best way to do that particular game is.
Yeah.
But I think we all, when reading that, you really recognize it like, oh, this, a better job could have been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking about the extra challenge involved in writing instructions for big games, right? So, like, I think GLOM's rules are pretty light.
That's true.
Everything on the first page of the instructions, we've got components. Great. You want to start there. Setup. Cool. Standard play. All right. Awesome. We're ready to go. And you can see that the standard play isn't the entire rest of the page. So it's not very intimidating. It's like six steps.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then the bottom one is, what is a GLOM? Right? So now you understand the game.
So, I mean, one, I think examples we could pull up that are like for bigger games are video games. I think that oftentimes those are large and have a ton of systems in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, video games kind of have the advantage in that they can tutorialize things better than board games often can.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because we can force players to do a thing and then they can see the context of what they're doing.
You also don't have to understand how it works to experience it.
Absolutely.
Even if it's important for you to understand it later.
Yeah. But instructions are an important part of video games as well, because not everything requires a tutorial, right? Like, you should say, click here to add a thing to your inventory or whatever, right? Like, that needs to be instructions, and you need to make that clear to the player how to do it and how to interact with it, how the inventory works.
Yeah,
because if the user interface might be drawing upon a lot of common conventions, since you can kind of rely on a player's intuition to drive them in those areas, maybe.
Yeah.
But anything that's like truly novel with the, especially probably the stuff that's related to the gameplay, is not necessarily going to be just intuitive.
Right.
So you have to have some sort of instruction.
And in addition to that, like, games tend to will have instructions on like how to, like, reminders specifically on how to do certain things. If you've gone through a tutorial and you're like, I don't actually know why I need to do this, and then you come back to it later, because that happens, it'll oftentimes like tell you the specifics of how this thing works after the fact. And so it's nice to have that in games that like require, that have a lot of systems.
Yeah, and there, I think there's a, for video games, that those pieces of text that they can't be intuited like through level design or that tutorialization, just are instructions.
Yes.
It is difficult when you write those to decide how much in the world those things should be.
Yeah.
Right? How much of a style it should be, how fourth wall breaking should it be, or how just what it is, please, so the player gets it, it should be. And I think games definitely do different approaches of that. I think when you notice it, that it feels of a style with the game, then that's usually a sign that it's gone too far, probably. I'm making a supposition, because if you notice it, but at the same time, it can be really easy just to be really dry and miss an opportunity to bring more theming to a game. Whereas in a board game, there's, I think the board game instructions are, because the task is a lot more sort of critical to the understanding of play, I think players would have a lot less patience for, like, you know, the theming invading that.
Yeah.
Even if you want some of the attitude and tone, this is a light game, so let's make the instructions, like, not, you know, let's not use 10-cent words, that sort of thing. Like, that makes sense, obviously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have a game that's Western theme, you don't necessarily want to have your...
Howdy, y'all.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah.
Or it's your first line. Nothing instructive is going to take that on.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, at the same time, I could see someone make an argument that you could do it right.
Yeah.
But I think in video games, I think the opportunity is worth taking. Mm. In board games, I would say you would want to be a lot more cautious.
Yeah, I would not write any instructive text with any sort of wild styling.
Like, yeah.
Keep it dry. You can add flavor to content at the beginning of the sentence or the end of the sentence or beginning of a section, right? Because that's kind of a transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people aren't really expecting anything, you know, instructive in those sentences.
Yeah, the instructions are not there to be a piece of entertainment. Mm-hmm. They should also not be a struggle. And so finding that balance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The entertainment is the system, which is why I think I wish that board game instructions as a whole would at least have one section that does kind of treat the mechanics just like you would a video game, where it's like, press this, and then do this.
Because
when you're doing a video game, like, and you're like just learning an action system, you're really slow and it's very awkward. Mm-hmm. But you learn the movement, and then once you like see the whole movement, you're like, oh, okay, I can see how this is supposed to feel.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with those like moment by moment actions.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
You know? I do want to shout out Wingspan, because it does exactly this. Mm-hmm. When I first, like, when I bought Wingspan for my brother, because he just moved into his house and he was looking for board games to have. Mm-hmm. And so I played it with him and a couple of my cousins, and we didn't know how to play. So I read the rules and I was like, this doesn't really make a lot of sense. But then there was this thing where you could just like play through the first turn for everyone. And so like it would tell you literally what to do each turn.
Yeah.
And it would give you context as to why you might want to do this thing, which was really helpful.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And that doesn't feel, I can imagine a type of player who would not have patience for that, who would not want to do that.
I mean, I had...
Even though it's good for them.
Well, I found that a lot more instructive than just reading the rules dry and trying to figure it out from there.
Yeah.
Because like at that point, I was just trying to figure out how to play the game. But when I played through this turn, and specifically what was helpful is watching other people do their turns and reading why they had to do what they were doing, or why it made sense for them to do what they were doing at the time, it became clear what I was actually doing in the game, why I was doing these actions, what the whole thing meant.
Yeah, and even like physically moving something from one side of the board to the other, or from one token pile, something like that can really give you a lot of context for why things are the way they are in a way that is not ever enumerated directly in the rule set.
Yes.
Because I think the most ambiguation I ever find in board game rules is when I can't tell two tokens apart because they have proper nouns. And like, yes, maybe they're illustrated somewhere, but like after that page, it's like takes a while to pick up or whatever.
Yeah.
I would argue that first turn run through might be a way to make Star Trek Ascendancy.
Ooh,
work. Yeah. Because that's one of the things, because like when I do praise that game, it's like it is a very, like, there isn't a lot, there is choice paralysis in it, but like it's a, like, you do this then this, there's, it's very, once you know how the turn structure works, it's very hard to forget.
Yeah.
The little specific rules you'll have to look up a lot, but like the actual thrust of the play, but that's never explained in the game, in the rules book, right?
Yeah.
But you know, just to maybe do a little like run through of some kind might go a long way. And then you can, when you start describing those systems, that just the context is there.
Mm-hmm. That might help. Yeah. I think it's a little easier for Wingspan because once you go through each player's turn,
yeah,
you get the context of the whole game. Whereas in Star Trek Ascendancy, you can't experience the whole game in one turn of play.
Right.
Because you got to do battles and negotiations and all this stuff. But like, you can still get kind of the gist, and then that'll help you. And then when you get to a point where you're like, what am I supposed to do now? It could give you more context.
Right.
As to what to do next in your future turns, which is what Wingspan did.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really helpful.
What that does is that's a perfect transition to sort of what I think should be like the last question of this topic.
Yeah.
Which is how important it is, if thinking just in the world of board games,
but yeah,
you can apply this to video games as well,
mm-hmm,
is it worth changing your design so that you can provide better instructions?
Oh.
Is the instructions part of your design? Because you could see saying like, if your game cannot be demonstrated that way,
mm-hmm,
then, which isn't to say that all games should work that way.
Sure, yeah.
But there maybe are some things where as you're writing the rule book,
mm-hmm,
and it's like, well, this is a little confusing. So how do we write this clearer? But we're not writing the manual for a VCR that works this a certain way.
Yeah.
We can change the way it works.
Right.
So that it's easier to explain.
Yes.
Is that, do people do that? And is that something worth considering when you're at that stage?
Hmm.
And is that an argument for like writing instructions as soon as possible or being open to changes later on?
Oh, that's interesting. I like the idea of you just writing instructions as soon as you can, just so you know how to play, mm-hmm, right? And you're being very deliberate about how you're describing it to other players.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cool. And as a result, like your design will likely change, especially if you do it right up, like, you know, at your first prototype or something. But I guess in terms of like actively changing your design to make it, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I feel like if you're at the point where you're like really locking down on instructions, at that point, your design should ideally be finalized.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't, it shouldn't be as easy as just changing how the game works in order to suit the instructions.
I'm seeing Ellen with her arms crossed,
yeah,
in deep thought. Also likely on Steven's page with this more than mine.
Yeah. I can imagine there maybe, I think if you're doing good game design, that's not going to come up,
mm-hmm,
because of how the human mind works. So let me explain.
Okay.
So we can trunk information in our mind, right? So,
right,
and this happens a lot with physical action. So you can, you know, think of a 10-digit phone number, but you think of it in chunks. 333-333-4.
Yeah.
444.
Sorry. You know what she meant.
Yeah. Anyway, it's 3 and 3 and 4.
Yeah.
It's similar for addresses. You can, yeah, chunk it out line by line, right? Or you like learn a cadence for how to say your address so that it can fit into the chunks of the cadence.
Right.
So that's just something that brains do to kind of make it more efficient to remember things, especially when it's stuff that you have to remember in like an active way,
mm-hmm,
like your phone number. But with movement, the same thing kind of happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with game instructions, if you're playtesting it enough, you will know when your systems and subsystems can't get to an intuitive place where people, yeah, are like referencing the game too much for it to be fun, or they're referencing the rules too often.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're watching that in playtesting, what you're gonna notice then is, oh, this system is too complicated.
Yeah.
And it's not that you're thinking of the instructions per se, it's just that you're thinking of your player's experience.
Sure. It might be a comorbidity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than an actual cause of the problem.
Yeah.
Right. You might want to change it, but there are bigger reasons, perhaps.
Right.
That's the case.
Mm-hmm.
So would you argue that there's essentially no, if a game design is correct, is not the right word, but it's the way you want it to be, it,
yeah,
works, you know, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Would you make the argument that there's no, that you can explain it? That there is an elegant way to write instructions for anything that is itself elegant, it works.
Yes, you might not have the chops to do it.
Yeah,
as an individual, yeah. Right? Like, but that's how I think. It's like if it gets to a state where people can play it intuitively without too much work,
yeah,
then there should be a way to express that in a way that reflects that intuition or engages that level of kind of intuitive thinking.
Yeah,
right.
I believe. It's just, it takes a lot of, I think it takes a lot of writing practice to get there.
I think it's an active adaptation.
Yeah.
Which I think opens the door to potential problems where it's, I guess I'm disagreeing,
okay.
but purely in a theoretical sense.
Okay.
Okay.
That in a, that you're adapting those actions into the written word. And so there's, you cannot replicate it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And so it feels to me that there must be a system that is elegant and teachable, but wouldn't be, you couldn't write good written instructions for it that don't have flaws.
I kind of agree with Mark.
Okay, it's our next game jam.
I would say this, but I think you've hit on the thing, which is like the put in the effort and you got to have the chops.
Yeah.
Because I would say that I would make that argument as theoretical insofar that like we may never discover that use case. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's, I guess it's an argument for the uniqueness of game mechanics as a medium.
Yeah.
But right. But the written word is so flexible. I also believe very deeply that it can do a lot. So mm-hmm. I don't mean to disagree fiercely, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this could get into a very like a very interesting discussion, like in the aesthetic sphere. Like, what does it mean to feel something, experience?
And, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. No. Okay. Well, we can save that for a different day. But I really well, do like the idea of like trying to create a game that you can't describe, that can only be taught into it, like. You know?
Yeah, that you have to experience.
That would be terrible for the podcast, Ellen. That's the only way we can tell people what we're doing.
Don't let Dale know. She'll make a prompt.
I know.
We'll put it on Patreon, and it's very exclusive and okay. Avant-garde.
Yeah.
Here's an avant-garde podcast. Fun.
Oh, gosh.
Well, tune in next week, because we'll have more to say on some of this in some dimension at some angle, I'm sure.
Yes. Good pitch, good pitch.
Yeah.
So recently we've gotten a significant bump in our listeners, and we wanted to ask all of these new listeners, why aren't you giving us money?
Steven.
He was so sly.
Look. I'm thinking about the bottom line here.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's true. We need to subsidize work trips like the one we took to Ellen's house.
Yes. Okay, in all seriousness, no. It is very helpful if you have the money and the means to give us a little bit of money.
How much money are we talking about
here? Honestly, any amount is great.
No, I mean, any amount. I mean, like, could I give you, like, $2.50.
Yes, you absolutely can.
Yeah. That's not too little.
It's not too
little. That's great.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Anything.
And scene.
Thank you, Mark. Any amount will be beneficial, and you get all the benefits of our Patreon, including ad-free episodes, exclusive Patreon content, and it just helps us keep the lights on with respect to the show. Ideally, you know, you're listening to the show, you like it, you want it to keep going. I hope that's the case.
Now you're hypnotizing our
yeah. And if so, if you can support us through Patreon, we would appreciate it. If you go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub, donate any amount. Thank you.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, I got a topic.
Uh-huh.
For some reason, even though this is my episode I was supposed to be hosting, I was just really excited to talk about cynicism?
What's like wrong the best transition we've had in a while?
This is weird.
Works on a couple of levels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my topic. Cynicism. What does that mean? I'm not going to give you the definition, but what I mean by that is actually interesting because there were two angles to it that I didn't, one of which I didn't consider, but then Mark brought it up when I was talking about maybe doing this topic. And we'll see.
And then, folks, he considered it.
And then I considered it. We'll see if we get to that by the end of this. I think we might, but we'll see. But my angle on cynicism was me recognizing that because I've been in the working on games for as long as I have been, I've started to recognize that I know how much work it takes to like do a certain thing, and it'll keep me from wanting to do that thing. And what that also means is that when other people come to me with ideas because they're excited and they're maybe new game devs, or they're hobbyists or something like that, and they're like, "Oh, this would be a really cool idea. What do you think?" I have to really hold my tongue and not be like, "This is way too hard. This is way beyond scope. You're not going to be able to do this. You don't even know how to program yet. Why are you?" I can't. I can't. I don't want to crush people's dreams.
Yeah, you've got grumpy old disease, is what you got.
I do. It sucks. So I guess I wanted to talk about that a little bit on the show, specifically like what that means, why that's the case, and if I'm the only one here in the clubhouse who experiences this. When I've had these conversations in the past, I up front will say, you know, I've been doing this for a while. I kind of have to do this for my job. This idea seems out of scope. I try to be upfront about it.
Yeah.
But I also try to be upfront about saying like, well, I'm not the one necessarily working on this thing. So it's okay that I feel like it's too much work because it doesn't matter what I think. But also, I also like want people to be able to, you know, follow their heart. So I'll try to like bring up ways to like make it fit more within a scope. Within a smaller scope.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things we do try to talk about. We talk about on the show a lot of times is like keep things within scope. Try to make things small because like it's easy to become ambitious and then scope creep will come in and the game will become too large for you to feel comfortable completing. Right. And that's a danger. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to warn people against.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's something I'm warning people against because I have experienced that and it sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I don't know. What are your experiences with this particular issue?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
Think about it. Pass it back to Mark.
Fair enough, Mark.
You know, Steven, of the three of us, you're the sunshiniest.
Oh no.
Of the nice hosts. So you best believe I got grumpy old disease. I've had these like within. Like on Dream Settler,
yeah.
I've definitely, because I'm the one who has the most technical background
in the
tool sets we're using,
mm-hmm.
I've definitely had to break some hearts in a way that like part of me is like, or I don't know, should I just let us reach and just see?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, it's one thing to tell someone in a game jam, like, make it smaller.
Yeah.
Like that's just good advice.
Right.
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 They're going to have fun anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and it's another thing to... Because you get kind of invested. It's like, I'm going to have to deal with the fallout of this overreach.
Right.
And I do have to remind myself, like, okay, really think about this. Is this really something I don't want to do?
Yeah.
Or is it like, or rather not don't want to do, don't want to try.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the way you brought that up because that's something I've been experiencing too. Is because I know, I recognize that this is going to take a lot of effort. I'm like, I'm not going to do this. It's going to take too much work. And then I don't want to do it. As a result.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it sounds like that might be something you're experiencing too.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't have a good answer for it. I think it's just you kind of watch yourself a little bit.
Mm.
And at the same time, because it's difficult because when you start developing that sense of like what's of the possible, it's powerful and it makes you feel good about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then it will be, then it turns into this.
Yes.
Right. And I guess it's sort of, you got to go back and forth, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's helped to me to like see how other people are excited about a thing.
Yeah.
And recognize that like I can be excited about this thing too.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that like makes it a little bit more viable, at least for me, or in my mind, to make it more viable for me to work on. Which I think helps. And oh, I think also what's helped me about it is too, like, I'll think like, oh, this is going to take too much work. Then I'll like actively really start thinking about it. And I'll recognize that, yeah, it might take a little bit more work than I would like to do, but it's not as bad as I think it is.
Yeah.
And I'm being given the space with which to do this work, which will help.
That's key.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be like, and that's the thing when we budget our time.
Yeah.
We tend not to budget like failure and goof around.
Yes.
And experimentation.
Yeah.
And even when we do, we tend to give it not enough
time. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I will say that there's a piece of advice that I pull from my old career,
yeah,
working with clients.
Okay.
Which is when they want something done, they'll often have specific ways of wanting to do it.
Uh-huh.
And if you ever worked in commercial video, you know that no client knows how to do your job.
Yeah.
And if you ever worked with clients of any kind, you know your client doesn't know how to do your job.
Right.
But you also have to know that, like, in those cases, at least in that context, mm-hmm, in games, it's different unless you are working directly for a client.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that what they're asking is you need to make something that gives them what they want, not necessarily exactly what they say.
Yes.
And so one of the techniques that I would develop with clients is to stay in engaging conversation with them.
Okay.
To find out, oh, you want it to do this.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to say this or animate this way or be this long. And I know that those are problems.
Yeah.
And so I will sort of set that aside and say, why do you want it to do that? What's the goal you want? What is the result you want coming out of this?
Yeah.
And then it's my job to get you to that result.
Right. Okay. Okay.
And then you get to optimize and you get to do the smallest amount of work to get the biggest amount of impact.
Yeah.
And I have done that in games.
Yeah.
Where I think about, go back to the design and think about like, what is the point of this design? And what is the player supposed to feel?
Yes.
And how few menu options, how few systems, how little can I do to make them feel that?
Yeah.
And some of that, at least in the case of Dream Settler, because it's a simulator in a sense, is like, what do we have to do to provide that real experience, and what do we fake to provide that real feeling?
Yeah.
And so that's the context on this project.
Yeah.
But other projects, it can be similar, which is, you know, like, I want the player to feel powerful, so I'm going to set up 10 different special moves. But like, really, they want the idea that they can do anything.
Yeah.
And so how can I make them feel like they can do anything without actually having to like program out everything?
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, apply your context thusly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Mark. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Ellen, you got an answer for me now?
It's frustrating because that's exactly the line of thinking I was going to say. Yeah, I was going to say, Stephen, I don't think I have that feeling when it regards to the work and how it's done.
Okay.
I sometimes get cynical in regards to, like, corporate America.
You know, fair.
But when it comes to actually, like, working with people on a project and mm-hmm. bringing it into existence,
yeah,
for me, it's never really about the vision I have. It's trying to, like, do the best we can within the constraints we have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I like discovering constraints up front because it helps me reach that end goal mm-hmm. more clearly.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have a fuzzy idea of what you know, if you have a good idea of what you achieved, but you have a fuzzy idea of what the constraints were, you can't know how well you did.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's, I think that comes from just practice on doing so many different types and sizes of projects.
Yeah.
In the way that Mark described, right? So, like, and just kind of having those different sizes and different, like, vastly different outcomes and style and scope and content, like, you can never compare, you can never rate your performance by, like, how this one project went to that one in terms of its size or its schedule. Like,
yeah,
it's, there are so many variables.
Right.
So you just have to, like, practice that and get intuition about, in this situation, what is the best that can happen given our constraints, and then try to push yourself to that. Mm-hmm. So I think in that instance, when somebody is like, hey, can we do this? And I know it's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
I am kind of processing that request in that algorithm. It's like, what is the best given the constraints that we have?
Okay.
And if it's like, okay, if we do this, it's going to blow that one constraint.
Yeah.
And one of the constraints is like, don't burn out.
Right.
You know? Then I say, okay, I think, like, given what we need to do here, we can't necessarily go you know, 120%, can we bring it back to 90%, you know, or, you know,
okay,
something like that. So I think it's just thinking about the parameters like of the project, you know,
sure,
in a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the, it's a mindset thing.
Yeah, I think yeah. so. I think
no,
so.
No, no, no. I think that totally makes sense. And I think that's kind of what I started to recognize, or I've been kind of working at a little bit better, is recognizing that, like, this seems like a lot of work because maybe I don't want to do it. but if I recognize that this seems like a lot of work, but it would definitely improve the game, that helps me feel better about it.
Yeah, I think you got to answer that to what end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
because
yes.
that has to feel valuable.
Yeah, yeah, because sometimes it's like people. Well, I think part of why I'm experiencing this too is because I'm the programmer of Future Club, and the only one who mm-hmm. I'm the one who has to code it. And so like when people are like, "Oh, this seems like it would be a good idea for the design of the game, Stephen, can you do this thing?" I'm like, "Oh man, I gotta do it."
yeah,
and that makes it kind
of
hard.
It's a bunch of architects and just one bricklayer.
Yeah. Kind of accurate sometimes, but like if I understand why these things are getting implemented, I can, first off, I can argue against it, because like sometimes I'm like, this doesn't actually solve the problem, because I also have a designer's mind, but if I know why I'm doing it, then like I can be like, yeah, this actually does make a lot of sense, it will improve this aspect, I have recognized this flaw in the game as well, and we need to do something about it. This seems like
yeah.
at least something we could do, and I don't have any better ideas. So.
Yeah, and I think the communication strategies are maybe the trickiest part.
Yeah.
It's like, how, especially if you're dealing with someone who doesn't understand the constraints as you can understand them,
mm-hmm.
to get them to understand that you're applying your technical constraints, not design constraints.
Yes.
Necessarily. Because to them, it will sound very similar.
Right.
And I think, you know, maybe the a way around that is to really engage with the design goals.
Yeah.
Because, and this is something you'll rarely hear me or any of us say on the show, but like scope creep is not as big a problem with that kind of thing in a sense where, because you can do a lot with a little.
Yeah.
And I think when we tell, and maybe it's a mistake sometimes when we tell people to make their things smaller.
Okay.
It's you know, make it smaller, then cut it in half, then make it 10 times smaller.
Yeah.
Like that's the advice we give people, yeah. not just in game jams, but all the time.
Yeah.
In terms of scope creep.
Right.
But I think people take that to mean that that means that their game is going to be that much less impactful, or it's going to do that much
right.
less, say that much less of what they wanted to say.
Yeah.
And I think that the, again, the, sort of back to Mark's theoretical notions rather than provable theorems.
Sure.
You know, there is no upper bounds to those things.
Yeah.
And so, but there's incredibly low bounds to the implementations
yes.
To many things. Yeah. And it is very easy to think this needs to be built this way and then realizing that it's too big. And yeah. I think if you get dissuaded or frustrated by that, try to take some heart. And this takes practice. This takes experience. It takes it takes skill and it takes talent, which is to be able to execute something that is really big, that is bold and huge. In something that's a tenth the size of how you envisioned it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with making no compromises.
Yeah,
and that, I mean, that's scary, but it's a good kind of scary,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like that aspect of it. Yeah, and I think that like recognizing or being able to know that for myself, being able to know what the purpose of this thing is, it you know, just solidifies a lot of that stuff in your head in a way that I think is so important, and especially it can help you feel more basically, I guess, like I noticed that like I'll have a way on how I'm supposed to design this thing in my head, and then I'll tell somebody about it, and then you know they'll be like, why do you have to do it in this way, right? And it'll be like, because and then you had to think it through, right?
Yeah,
this is part of the experience I've had, you know, it's kind of interesting, this is part of the experience I've had during, working on my custom Spirit in Spirit Island. Is like initially I was like, well, we got to do it this way, because I don't know, this seems like it's the theme of the Spirit, and it should do all of these things, and it was like way too many things. It didn't need all of this stuff, and people were like, why is it doing all this stuff? Well, because, and then I was, you know, I really had to think about it, and I'm like, you know, it doesn't actually have to be this way. There are other ways to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It could be simpler.
Yeah.
And so it really helped me pare down what it was, and now I still feel like I have something pretty fun and solid. But it still feels to the core of what I wanted in the past.
And so you have stronger. the additional accomplishment of doing it elegantly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elegance is great. This is great. Thanks. I feel more confident about myself. And I will try to be less cynical in the future.
I think, maybe that was cynicism. I think it was caution and then frustration about not knowing what to do with your caution.
Yeah. Well, it sometimes manifested in recognizing in other people they're working on something that's too hard. That's why I call it cynicism. Mm,
yeah.
Because at that point, I have no business telling people what they should do.
Fair enough.
I wanted to bring up also Mark's angle on cynicism as a topic.
Folks, I had an angle.
Do you want to describe it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Steve, when you were saying, like, hey, I'm the host of this episode, but I have a topic. And I was like, Steven, that's not how we do things.
That's exactly how I said it, yes.
And then you told me, it's about cynicism in games. And I you know, you started to describe it. And I was like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, actually, the way I was thinking about when you first said it was the idea of, like, the expression of game of cynicism within games.
Yeah.
Which as we talked it out, I think can be a product of the cynicism of workflow.
I agree.
Because I was thinking about, like, you know, doing more with less and then doing more with more and how a lot of times players cannot tell the difference.
Right.
And so, like, was it really worth doing more?
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
I think Breath of the Wild, Tears of the Kingdom are great examples of, like, games that are described by most people as, like, you know, vast and AAA and, like, enormous and the biggest of the big games, you know. I mean, I think people understand that it's, like, on the Switch. It's not as technically, you know, powerful as, you know, a certain game or whatever.
Yeah.
But people do tend to sort of put it in that category. But you really analyze the components. Like, there's so little going on in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we talked about this when we had an episode on elegance.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, it can be really easy to be cynical and within games and betray kind of those bigger ideas by just putting in what games need to have.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
By, like, let's make this look prettier because, like, it needs to look prettier than the last one.
Right.
And, like, I'm not saying anyone's at their desk saying that out loud.
Right.
I would argue no one's doing it that way.
Uh-huh.
But I think that is all sometimes becomes the result, and that's the reason people do things, for cynical reasons.
Yeah.
And that happens in games a lot. And I think one of the big ones, and I think we've talked about this a lot recently, which is just that games are so big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that you have all this content to fill. Eventually, it's going to start to be self-referential, ironic, comedic, no matter how serious the narrative is.
Yeah.
And that is a product of cynicism. Mm. And you kind of can't help it because it's just you've wrung all of the drama out of this setting, this narrative. All that's left that's interesting to you are jokes.
Yeah.
And to the player as well. Mm. And that is a consequence of how big games are.
Mm.
But that is a result of a sort of cynical attitude about games have to be big because otherwise, you know, it's not enough.
I do want to emphasize when you say jokes, you're talking about jokes at the expense of the game, not necessarily jokes. Because, like, Breath of the Wild has jokes, right?
Sure. That's comedy is not the problem.
Right, exactly.
It's when, you know, you find the audio log in a serious drama or a horror game.
Yeah.
And horror and comedy go together. But so this is not an indictment on any specific example, but I do see it quite often where you have a game that has ostensibly a serious narrative, which isn't to say that it's not, you know, aware of itself or has comedy, but then you'll find something that just completely betrays the reality of the game in a meta, fourth wall breaking audio log or something that you're meant to laugh at as the player. That happens way too often. It's like a core, it's like a lodestone of video games.
Yeah.
And in a way that, like, it is not itself a bad practice, but it's so frequently used. I mean, like, Assassin's Creed is full of this.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, it is just a result of games being too big to be filled with enough sincerity. And so you fill the rest with cynicism.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of trying to tie our topics to our sort of half topics together because I feel like one does lead to the other.
Yeah, no, the way that you described it in particular, in that, like, how this is how video games are supposed to be, so you have to put it, so you have to do it this way, is totally what I was talking about as well, right?
Yeah.
Like, because people are describing this video game to me, and I'm like, this is how it has to work. This is too much work. I'm not thinking it all through because that's just my knee-jerk reaction. But like, if you think it through and you're like, oh, well, this is what we want to do in it. This is why we want to do it. Maybe we can do it a different way that makes more sense for the game, in a way that like still brings value but doesn't, you know, break our budget or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it was really helpful. And I think you're right in that like a lot of games they're so large, like they have to keep filling it with content, and eventually you get to a point where there's just too much stuff in there, and not all of it is going to serve the game in a way that is valuable.
And scale is just one way this happens.
Yeah.
So like another way is, you know, you have a mascot fighter game.
Yeah.
Or even just any old fighting game.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, think about all the fighting styles that your players might have or you're designing for.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe four or five core sort of styles would make sense for your design.
Yeah.
Gotta have 12 characters.
Right.
Like you can't do four or five. It's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You're not gonna, it's because people aren't gonna be able to like engage with it in the way that it needs to be engaged
right.
with.
And so some of them feel redundant, or some of them are undercooked and things like that.
And you know, there is also a non-cynical reason to do something like that, which is to say like it is actually important to support the sort of aesthetic expression of players.
Yeah.
And so there's not automatically this is a problem.
Right.
But I think oftentimes it's done so that you can have a large roster, because that's valuable. You know, likewise with games that are that have like crafting systems.
Yeah.
A lot of times they are, you know, they're robust because that's what they need to be.
Mm.
When a simpler way might have supported the gameplay a little bit better.
Right.
But might have been seen as not deep enough or not interesting enough.
Yeah.
Even though it would have tied better into the sort of other systems.
Yeah.
Or you know, just all sorts of ways games are designed, not just because that's the way the games are, but because it's what the players expect of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And things that are done that way just because not flowed from the design pillars of that game.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I think that it's, I don't know, it's like this, it sounded a little bit like one of Steven's complaining about games categories, but I'm in your topic, so I get to do it.
Yeah. It's true.
But I find it, it makes me really sad.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like, it just, it's like so much effort is, games are so hard to make.
Yeah.
And I feel like we spend, like as an industry, we spend about 80% of that time
thinking about what the player wants and what the player needs.
Well, that's a question worth answering. But I mean, not thinking about what the game needs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah. Putting more emphasis on, well, you do mean to put emphasis on the player. Like the game might be served better if it didn't do everything the player expected.
Right. Like, you know, to holding up conventions or even subverting them, it can be done cynically, right? There's no, like, you know, I've got examples here, but like just that, I think you can see that attitude a lot in a lot of the games you play.
Yeah.
Like it works this way for reasons that are not pure to its design.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Ellen's thinking.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about a phrase from one of my favorite books where the characters are like asking themselves, how do you define good? How do we know what good means? Yeah. Isn't it something that you kind of feel?
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about how I wonder if the idea of complete, like the feeling of complete, is kind of similar.
Hmm. Yes.
You know? So if it's complete, then there's nothing more interesting enough to include.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that requires a lot of rigor.
Yeah. A lot of discipline.
To like understand when that is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it can, I mean, you know, that rigor can also solve the sort of cynicism that you were talking about a lot, Stephen, which is to say like a lot of that work, figuring out what it needs, can take time that you then save when you realize how much less you have to do.
Yeah.
You know, to achieve what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a promise. You know, big things sometimes just take more time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's not a magic trick.
Mm.
But, it is all, dare I say it, everything is everything.
Yep.
Once again, every time. It gets us every time. You never see it coming, and then bam, everything.
We have to say it in every city we go to, I think.
Oh, is that how it works? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I live here again, so.
Cool.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club. where Dale posts about Game Dev Resources and Wind Waker, but Link controls Vibes.
It's very fun. It's a cool animation.
What? Vibes?
Oh, now I know. I remember this.
It's great, right?
It's great.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm excited.
Reply on the various platforms, pretty much Threads, or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. If you didn't hear Steven make an earnest plea, not a tricksy one or anything.
No.
I'll make another one for you now. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be discussing our Robostin work that we're doing tomorrow. That's it for this week. So, till we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Mark?
Uh-huh.
Did you deliberately match your mouse to your phone case?
No, but I do like pink and peach as an accent color.
Yeah. Okay.
My shoes are pink. My phone is little pink.
Cool. It's a good color.
It's the thing I'm into.
He has pink shoes. I don't think he brought the pink shoes with him. Oh. You were wearing the blue shoes.
I was wearing the blue shoes.
Oh, yep. I remember now.
Yeah. Are we in outtake mode or is this leading to something?
Ellen just had a question. Pretty... I guess.
Okay.
All right. Call to action, Patreon.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.